Welcome to the Bioelectronics Podcast by Neurocore. I'm your host, Rick Rowan, and this is where we can hear about how bioelectronics is changing healthcare and providing benefits to both patients and healthcare systems worldwide. Welcome to the Bioelectronics Podcast. This week, our guests are Liam Grimley, rehabilitator and trainer, and Dr. James Somerou, our regular co-host on the program. Welcome both.
Hey, Rick.
Good morning, Harry.
Liam, would you like to give us a bit of information around yourself and what being a rehabilitator and trainer encompasses?
I'm Liam Grimley, rehabilitator and trainer. In a nutshell, I'm a private practitioner, a sole practitioner. I look after and help to rehabilitate sports and non-sports people with typically musculoskeletal injuries. Mm-hmm. The trainer side comes in where I've taken it sort of to the step beyond just helping people with pain and injury, but to help them return to sport, but also hopefully return stronger and also maybe a little bit wiser, so they don't have to experience these injuries again.
The wiser part, probably the biggest challenge, is it?
I hope so. Well, it is, especially with me involved. No, I'd like to impart a bit of knowledge, you know, to help that person feel that they've understood, you know, perhaps why they had a problem in the first place, and then give them some tools mm-hmm. which to take care of, best, slightly better care of themselves afterwards. Early on in my rehab career, I sort of realized, whilst my training was fairly clinical and a bit serious and dry, and possibly a little bit snobby, it was like the idea of, you're kind of quasi-medical and you know, things are going to be very, almost kind of like, white coat stuff. But actually, far from distancing myself from the fitness world and the massage world, I learned very early on to embrace those things. So far from just treating someone who's in pain, to help them to exercise better and to look after themselves better became apparent to me very early on.
When lockdown happened, I'm assuming that, you know, that would have made some changes, whether they were positive or negative. But what did you see, both from your side as a rehabilitator and trainer, as well as from your patient or client side? What, you know, did you see impact their changes?
Very much so, yeah. I think initially, I'm a reasonable rule follower. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the very morning of the morning before that, the UK or England announced the some formal lockdown, I'd sort of taken my last taught my last outdoor fitness class, mm-hmm. and I said to everybody that this feels a bit wrong. I think this might be our last class. I put into what I thought was sensible distancing measures and stuff like that, which I think we'd all been starting to adopt sensibly. To answer the question, almost immediately, classes for me ceased, certainly on a client-facing basis. Took me a few weeks to adopt this fantastic thing we call Zoom. So I took my class from being, client-facing, which is very much my sort of my ethos. I like to be personal and personable, mm-hmm. and face-to-face is the way I like to work. So it was I needed to adapt and adopt.
Yeah.
So I went to suddenly doing classes Monday to Friday, suddenly on Zoom as quickly as I could, and that was actually taken up really well. Mm-hmm. So positive to that was it gave me some of it slightly amusing. It gave me a bit more of the people's attention. So rather than being one of a crowd of 15 to 20, mm-hmm. There's definitely less heckling, which is nice. But also there was it was kind of like me being in your front room. So I was able to bring in some other things that I hadn't always been able to share, like breathing practices and different stretching techniques, and I'd spend a little bit more time on some of the body control stuff that I think is really important that I didn't always have a chance to do in a big group, out on the grass in the mud. So that was definitely a positive of taking the fitness side of the business online. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, with regard to the rehab stuff, I felt you lose a great deal from being in that private room setting with the individual. Because you read a lot more in those interactions than just the subject to objective examination, etc. I was a little bit slower to adapt to that, but I did start to do. I had some pretty desperate people saying, "Look, I really need some help." So I said, let's have a go at this Zoom thing. And I managed to adapt and make a method that I could do, you know, do some good. Yeah, because I'm also quite hands-on, so I do a lot of soft tissue work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a challenge, which again, I think has stretched the brain a little bit, which has been really nice. It's been good to be able to help those people. It was a matter of feeling like I'd let them down if I wasn't able to offer them some help. But also, from a business point of view, you know, they're going to need to see someone. And I know that there were some practitioners, even early on, who were still seeing clients, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
I've still not returned to the client-facing, you know, PPD mask stuff.
Yeah.
Partly because we had our first child arrive during lockdown. So,
you're reading my mind, actually. I forgot to ask you. You're recently a new dad, yes?
That's right, yeah. Albie's just 4 months this week. That's been something to adopt as well. So I think with regards to sticking to the guidelines of COVID controls and stuff, we've been probably a little stricter than others because of the new little guy. So, but again, there have been some positives. So I've been able to, I guess, in a way, develop a method that I might take forward for online rehab coaching in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Still missed out on that very personal and certainly the soft tissue work that I think is so important. But in some ways, it's also helped me to develop perhaps slightly better communication skills, which I'm not necessarily conveying brilliantly right now. But finding a way to communicate with people more succinctly. Mm. I tend to ramble a bit in the room, and often have a bit too much fun, I think, rather than getting down to business and fixing it.
A lot have had to adapt, and many have adapted well. Sounds like you have from a client patient perspective, but you know, it is you just can't replace that personal interaction and a lot of the nuances that go along with it. Similarly, I suppose the same for a lot of clinicians. James are having the same struggles. I know that teledoctors or Zoom doctor appointments are obviously, you know, exponentially growing, but they're having some same challenges, even, you know, from just a simple chat that often a GP will have with the patient.
I think that's it, right? You said it, you know, you can't replace in person. There's been a lot recently that a lot of the kind of, you know, the telemedicine models, and people are talking about telemedicine consultations a lot, as you've said, but people are realizing that telemedicine is great. It's just not for everything. But similarly, in-person is great. It's just not for everything. As you've alluded to, Liam, there are also positives that come out of it, and there are learning experiences that do come out of it. And so it's funny, you know, I've spoken to even behavioral scientists quite recently about this and about, you know, what's going to stick, what do we think is going to stay. And people, to be honest, mostly they've reverted to, we don't know. It's like, yes, okay, I know you don't know, but what do you think? But it's been that it depends what turns out to have actual utility. It depends what's actually going to be most useful. And that's why they revert to we don't know, because actually when everybody has their freedom back again and you know, we can consult with our GP however we like, there are going to be some people that prefer telemedicine. There are going to be some people that have converted in that time. There are also similarly going to be some people who actually really don't want to do that anymore and cannot stand the thought of it. And so I suppose what we don't know is how it's going to be at scale, but we know that there's going to be lots of people that have found that utility in this time. And so things are going to change. We're just not sure how much.
Absolutely. I think it's nice to feel that I'm going to keep these tools in the toolbox, so to speak.
You know? Yeah.
I had one or two clients in the last couple of years who've emigrated. And I've always been a little bit funny about the sort of, the online coaching thing and online care, only because my approach is very, very personal. But that being said, I think I've kind of loosened up a bit and thought, well, actually, as you rightly said, James, I think sometimes it is, it's not for everyone, but that some people would massively benefit, and why not offer it to those people? Why neglect them, that brilliant thing? So absolutely, yeah, definite positive to take from this whole thing.
It's that thing about necessity being the mother of invention as well. We had to use it. We had to adopt it. We had to get over that more difficult part of the journey, which is learning a new platform. We had to do all of that stuff. And so in doing that, yes, you're going to have the people that hate it and never want to do it again. But as I say, you know, as you've experienced, you're one of those people that learned it and got over that and were like, well, actually, I can see the value in a few of these cases. Actually, I can now use this going forwards. And as you quite rightly put it, it becomes a tool in the box, which again is an unintended benefit of, I suppose, having your hand forced at a population level. There's always going to be people that go to that that go to that level with new tech.
If I recall, Liam, it was actually during lockdown that you got introduced to our products, was it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the Bioelectronics products. Yes. And I think it was the little MyBody, the wearable devices initially.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
And
I've got along really well with it.
Yeah, I mean, I love following your social media and all the places that our products end up being used. But could you give us a little bit of insight into how you've been using bioelectronics, particularly, I suppose, in the initial stages when, you know, things were somewhat restricted?
I think something I wanted to raise actually was back in my training, so the best part of 20 years ago when I was doing my rehab degree, we were trained in electrotherapy as we taught, you know, we taught it at the time. So, you know, I think the most closely related modality would be interferential electrotherapy. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, 2 to 4 sticky pads and, use, again, of electric current. Mm-hmm. And I found it terribly intriguing. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I imagined incorporating in my practice, but back then the devices were quite expensive. They cost a great deal and were large devices, and I was at the time either working in rugby clubs, I did a little bit of work with GB fencing, and also I was starting my own practice, so the cost side of it was quite prohibitive. But also a lot of the chat at the time, and I've got friends now who are either in rehab or physiotherapy, and a lot of it about what I would still, like, in some ways, refer to as electrotherapy, was, there's a lack of evidence for efficacy, or it's no better than heat and ice, or you're just getting a pain gate effect. And I found that downplayed things a little bit. I felt that showed either the individual hadn't perhaps looked deeply into the potential of the modality.
That's a very politically polite way.
But also, I think I get a little bit bored sometimes. People saying, "Oh, there's lack of evidence." You know, I think that just because something hasn't been evidenced doesn't mean that that it's not. It can be enormously useful or even revolutionary. And one of the things that attracts me to you guys is that you are contributing so significantly to the evidence base, and I think that's invaluable. It also shows that you guys are coming from a really strong position, and that's really intriguing. I'm going to try and wade my way through the evidence and learn as much as I can, not least to convince the detractors that this is good stuff.
Back to your point about potentially they hadn't looked into it. I would argue that the evidence is overwhelming in regards to efficacy. It's just you need to understand the way that bioelectronics or electrical stimulation works in order to understand how these studies are conducted and why, what to look for in them and how they're applied. I mean, we are at the moment doing another literature review because there are so many new studies available now, particularly in the last 2 years, that our literature review is out of date. You know, even 6 months from now, it will probably be out of date. But, you know, we have to put a cap on how much resource we put into this. What we're more focused on now is the development of those protocols and you know, what we already understand, to the point where we're simply not interested in arguing whether or not it's effective for any number of things, whether it's for physical performance or whether it's, as you mentioned, in regards to pain or injury management. That evidence, as far as we're concerned, and I think that we probably would be one of the most prominent, or I don't know what the correct terminology is, but we were definitely on the front with regards to level and quantitative research in the area, particularly the collation of it, because we use it for everything that we do, including formulation and development. What needs to happen is that rather than, you know, discussing whether or not the evidence exists, that's not for us. That's not even in the discussion anymore. We're well past that. It's about how to utilize that evidence in development. And, you know, the range of studies that we do, and people always say, well, where's your clinical evidence? And James and I have covered this quite a few times. You know, similarly, you need to look at it in the same way that pharmaceutical companies look at chemical compounds, is that if you were doing presenting a biosimilar, such as paracetamol or an NSAID or an opiate, you don't need to redo the studies on those specific compounds. And similarly, you know, if we're using a specific frequency that already has the evidence behind it or particular parameters for an objective, then we don't need to redo those. And, you know, that is what we use in developing formulations. But what we're interested in is what is the most effective combination for specific use. And, you know, the devices that you've used thus far, they're punching well above their weight. There's no question about that. They were never designed for professional rehabilitators and trainers like yourself to, you know, to be, you know, the ultimate tool. They were designed for broad consumer use for a range of things and nothing, you know, specific or special. But as you've probably found out, you know, when you combine known things like, you know, particularly muscle activation, frequencies that are useful for improving circulation, as well as, you know, that circulation being able to reduce things like microinflammation and just general recovery, good recovery practice, that, you know, they're quite effective tools, particularly for personal use.
Absolutely. I think the wearable nature of the MyBody is fantastic. You know, I certainly keep it in my well, not at the moment, but it would be in my gym bag if I was going to the gym. but I certainly keep it on me when we travel a few hours down the road to the mountains and I'm, you know, hitting some serious trails. It's almost it's as integral in my cool down and recovery process as anything else. And that those are subjects that I talk about quite a lot. And I found that the MyBody to be a great piece of kit. I mean, it couldn't be simpler in application, and it's super user friendly, which is really nice. I just love the sort of non pharmaceutical nature of it is fantastic. You know, the contraindications are quite small. Safety factors are great. So if I were to certainly when I'm back in a position of full practice with you know, clients coming in through the door, you know, all the time, it's something that I think I'd like to make everybody aware of, because I've always been a little, I've certainly been minimal in the advice that I might give, whilst I don't prescribe, the advice I might give regarding, you know, analgesia and anti-inflammatories. We all know, and I think increasingly, we know that you know, side effects of medications or contraindications for medications are a bit of a hurdle. I think if I had a quid for every client that said to me, oh, I don't like taking pills, sort of Scrooge McDuck rich. So the concept is just fantastic for me. I think what intrigues me enormously, which I haven't had an experience with yet, is the potentials for microcurrent. Obviously, in my practice, something I haven't alluded to yet, but my peppered injury history of my own, which inspired my career, the microcurrent stuff regarding sort of wound healing, tissue healing is absolutely fantastic and something I'm keen to learn more of and hopefully get some personal experience with and clinical experience with as well.
I mean that particular area of science is similarly fascinating for us. I mean it is in its very infant stages by way of development, but certainly there's a lot of pre-existing study and clinical evidence. Actually, I'll shoot you over a paper after this chat that I'm sure you'll find fascinating, particularly around the healing and tissue repair side.
Well, please do. Yeah, thank you.
And you know, something that James and I also do cover quite a bit, or have covered quite a bit as an interest point on this podcast, simply because you know, for the same reasons that you alluded to with you know, other clients, etc. The thing is that what is the option? You know, if someone is injury prone or has injury management or pain management needs, is outside of, you know, the pharmacological side and, you know, other physiological interventions, you know, there's not a lot of clinical interventions.
Rick, out of interest, I just wanted to ask a question. So often when we're looking at studies, particularly on studies for pain relief, one thing that's a number that's often brought up is the NNT. Have you come across that, the number needed to treat?
Honest answer, not specifically.
So what it is, it looks at if you gave everybody this medication, how many of them would need to take it before one of them felt relief? Now, for pain relief, that's, and they talk about a reduction of at least 50% of your pain. So they talk about 50% pain relief. So how many people do you need to give this to before somebody gets 50% pain relief? And it's interesting because I'm wondering what standards that bioelectronics is held to and how it's thought of, because even within pain relief, the number is often, well, it's between, at its lowest, it's 1.5, and at its highest, you know, it can be as high as 10, even 20, even on really rare occasions. So it takes, so it only works for 1 in 20 people, yet it still says it's effective and used, right? Which is super interesting, because pain relief is in a biochemical is held to that standard. But is that a standard that's different? And you've obviously done a lot with NICE guidance recently. Do you think bioelectronics is then held to a different standard?
Do you want the politically correct answer?
Yeah, let's get real, Rick.
I believe it is held to a completely different standard. And I believe it should be held to the same standards, because it should be, in some ways, it should be like for like, in that, you know, for pain application or for that application, as you say, what is that NNT? That's an interesting one. Thanks, James. What is that NNT number? Because, but as a comparator, I think it's quite an interesting point.
Well, I'm literally just looking at a study now. So tramadol 50, mm-hmm. NNT on a sample size of 770 people was 8.3. So it took giving tramadol to 8 people before one of them felt 50% pain reduction in a moderate amount of pain. So like, yet it's still indicated. And that's with all of the side effects of tramadol, by the way, which is a pretty foul drug once you're on it. And very difficult to come off.
That's a pretty low bar, isn't it? That was the statistic on the box saying buy our drug because with this effect, they might not peddle as many, completely guessing. But given that, correct me if I'm way off base here, but so typical pharmaceutical works as usually like a blocks a receptor or inhibits or facilitates some kind of process like a lock and key thing, right? Mm-hmm. And these substances are typically synthetic in some way. So comparing that, in my mind, to an electrical frequency that, to my understanding, matches or is made to marry that of the body, we're looking at, I'd imagine, my money would be on the electrical, the bioelectrical
pathway. Ours is too, Liam. no secret. Yeah. I mean, there are numerous mechanisms, and again, James and I have discussed this on other programs or other episodes. You know, we don't completely understand. James can explain it better. We don't completely understand how, you know, anesthetic drugs work, but we know that they work. And similarly, there are a number of mechanisms that aren't completely understood in the same way. And it's the same reason that one individual may get very quick, short-term relief that can be short lasting or long lasting. Another individual, you know, may take a little bit longer for whichever mechanism to kick in, and it could also be short lasting or longer lasting. We've also seen many patients who have had cumulative benefit to the point where, you know, they're simply on a maintenance schedule, and maintenance being, you know, randomly whenever they need it. There's things like the change in the nerve itself, which we're able to see, you know, with latest tech, a whole range of things. But as I say, on a side by side, I think it's quite an interesting comparison that maybe we wouldn't go, you know, look at making something like that, you know, a public push at the moment, but certainly an interesting point from our side.
So the side by side thing for me that I find enormously exciting, and again, I hope my understanding of the two fields is decent enough that I'm not going to embarrass myself, but I would imagine that the contraindications and side effects and downstream effects of bioelectronics is quite different from the what happens with the use of pharmaceuticals, the subsequent metabolites, etc. You know, one being in my mind, one being cleaner than the other, and have perhaps being less complex. It's certainly very attractive for me in my practice, the way that my clients tend to speak about their attitudes towards pills and that kind of thing. And I guess looking at so some long-term chronic pain patients who might be on a pathway to or trying to delay, say, a total hip replacement or total knee, they'll start off on the, I guess, pain medication pathway of mildest effective pain medicine, hopefully. As they experience greater pain over time, or if a joint is degrading, for example, they might then be going up the ladder of more and more potent medications. And there are sort of, again, I hope I'm not off base here, but there are more sort of escalating complexities with the stronger, so to speak, drugs. And if there was an intervention that could come in and help these guys, you know, to not just to feel less pain, but to facilitate their rehabilitation, to keep movement good, to keep fitness prior to something as radical as a total hip or knee, then that's something that is exciting for me as a practitioner who would be helping them.
Yeah, for sure. I'll let James talk on the pain ladder or prescription ladder, but certainly two. I mean, there's also quite a number of studies that have shown the efficacy of using the two together, you know, as an adjunct to manage that, that, you know, that continual upscale, as well as the fact that, you know, you're using the actual physiological benefits of maintaining the joint to its best condition possible and as strong as possible, which any orthopedic surgeon would agree greatly increases the potential for successful outcome. James, did you want to?
Yeah, and it's dangerous, right? It just keeps going up and up, and it's to the fault of nobody, really. It's always interested me, that, to be honest. I can remember even when I was an anaesthetist, and I was training as an anaesthetist, and I was sat in pain clinics, and you hear the stories of those patients as to how they ended up on, you know, so much opiate. You can kind of you can see it. It was not to the fault of the patients. It was not to the fault, really, of even the clinicians who were just trying to do their best for them. It just ended up being the way it was, in the sense that it's easier to just at the end of the day solve someone's problem by giving them pain relief. You feel better as a clinician, you feel better as the patient. It just so happens that you're going to need more and more over time, and that long-term view often isn't taken. It's almost then that the adjuncts, like your kind of acupunctures and your other, you know, they end up being adjuncts. They're never the main show in town. And I think that is potentially something that could change. I think as we go on in time and people are far less happy to be focused on pure biochemical ways, you know, pills, drugs of solving their pain, I think there is room for a different main player in some people's treatment. And like we said about telemedicine, you know, it's good, but it's not for everybody. It's the same for every drug, every way of treating pain, every way of treating anything, to be perfectly honest. There's an optimum way of doing it for individuals. And I think that's one thing, I suppose, what I've learned with you guys in this podcast about bioelectronics, in the sense that there is no one size fits all. You don't take you might take a gram of paracetamol and give that to everybody and hope for the best, but that gram of paracetamol has been defined over a long period of time as being the exact dose of the exact compound that is going to deliver the most amount of pain for the most amount of people, and therefore it can be. And I think that's the journey that bioelectronics is on right now, if, you know, I understand you guys properly, right? Which is that you're taking this technology, which is adding electricity to the body's processes, both at a micro level and sometimes a more macro level when you're talking about muscles, micro if you're talking about cells. But we're at the stage now where we're experimenting with those pulse settings and those frequencies and all those different things to find out the silver bullet, to find out if there is a silver bullet, like a gram of paracetamol. Does that exist in bioelectronics, or does it indeed have to be more personalized to every single person? You know, we know from all the anecdotal stuff, don't we, that you've taken me through on many occasions, you know, all the different people that have pain relief after playing with your devices for a while, they find the thing that works over time. Mm-hmm. Some people hit it first off, you know, one for one, and there's always the argument that you'll get about placebo effect, but others will take their time and find that. And I think that for me is what's interesting, that it's a journey, right? And I think if you think about bioelectronics as you would biochemicals, well, how long have biochemicals had to refine what they do and get to where they are? Mm. I think bioelectronics is at the start of that. And that's why I suppose the potential when you're looking at it from, when you're looking at it as an operator in a company doing this, but then I suppose even as an investor in the space or all those different things, you look at the potential of it. And I think that's where it starts to get really interesting.
It does. Yeah.
I think one of the things you made me think of there is that the exciting potential of giving the individual, giving the patient or client a device and saying, you know, it is safe for you to experiment and find the settings, etc., that help you. You know, mm-hmm. his guidance. It's safe to do so. As you say, go on that journey to find what works for you, and indeed tweak it over time as you adapt to change, rehabilitate, etc. You're not going to prescribe. Well, I imagine a good doctor is not going to prescribe a box of medicine and say experiment. You know, because you just can't allow people to do that. What a fantastic piece of kit to be able to give people that control.
What's interesting there, though, is that you. I suppose you might do that if you say you can experiment between 0 and 1 gram of paracetamol, if we thought that paracetamol was going to change its efficacy based on the dose, like, you know, something like adrenaline does that. The amount that you give changes the action that it has on the body. And so you might say that for a drug, but you'd say it within this range is safe. And I think that's the thing. What I suppose you're saying, Rick, is that you can't set that thing to be unsafe. So at the end of the day,
we can't say absolute either. But
fair.
But I, you know, what one of the exciting things adding to that is, you know, we have technology on our side now. So in the same way, drug companies are also, you know, have the upside of technology for things like, you know, biosensors or physiological markers, biochemical markers with regards to personalization of medicine, which is a big area for AI. Similarly, it is for us, and, you know, and the dosing, the frequency, the personalization, as you said, Liam, over time, this is something with technology that is opening, you know, the superhighway for bioelectronics in ways that were never possible previously. You know, before we could use what we knew worked, and similarly with drugs, for some it was more efficacious than others. But now with the advent of personalization, the ability to personalize, you know, using an algorithm, using biosensors, using even if it's subjective feedback from the user, is just producing, you know, opportunity like never before.
That's fantastic. It certainly speaks to the way I do the way I carry out my rehab practice. So yeah. I will give some. I don't give any two people the same treatment. Mm-hmm. I can see two people with two rugby second rows with an ACL reconstruction. I'm not mm-hmm. going to give them the same protocol. I'll give them tools, and then given their feedback and their response to this particular stage of rehab, I said, "Well, here are your options. Tweak it mm-hmm. this way and that, as James suggested, within this dose or framework." That's how I like to do things.
That's a very interesting point. Just going back to our discussion earlier about study. So if you were, that's a very good point that you just made. So if you had one patient and you did this exercise and you did this physical treatment, and someone said to you, right, Liam, we're going to do a clinical study on how good you are at helping ACL recovery, but you must use exactly the same two exercises or two treatments for every patient, who knows what the outcome might be, but that's not how you would want to be judged, right? Your first point is, no, that patient's going to need something different to that patient, and so we go.
Most likely, yeah.
And that is the exact parallel with bioelectronics. Unfortunately, it's been judged in the past that the single application mechanism, whether it's frequency, whether it's the objective outcome, whatever it might be, instead of, you know, what's suitable for that patient, which is why all of our formulations are you know, multi-frequency protocols, because we've created formulas, recipes, whatever you want to call them, protocols for, you know, as combinations for, you know, in particular the consumer devices, for a very broad spectrum of use. And it's, you know, it's the same with any good practice, I think, and that is that, you know, it needs to be suitable or adapted for the patient itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're going to conduct a trial, you've got to limit those variables as far as possible, right? But it's almost antithetical to practice. Which I guess is why hopefully we don't take our practice inspiration from one single paper either.
Yeah. Very good point, yes. Thank you both for joining us this week. It's been a fascinating discussion. Good to talk again, James. Liam, great to have you on. Thanks for all the insight.
Thank you, Rick. It's been great to be here, and great chatting with you too, James.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Bioelectronics Podcast by NeuroCore and for making it to the end of this episode. If you enjoyed it, remember to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. We'd much appreciate it. And you can head to the description of this episode to follow us on all of our socials so you don't miss out on any of the latest bioelectronic content.